This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the Oxford historian Famers Dab Hoyoola, speaking with us today about the 18th century sexual revolution in England. Your book, Farah, comes with the title The Origins of Sex, by which I take you to mean the origin of our own currently modern attitudes toward sexual behaviors, both public and private. Maybe you can begin by setting up the frame of your story in Western Europe from the early Middle Ages to the late 17th century dawn of the Enlightenment. From what repressive fear-mongering do the new freedoms emerge?
You're right that my book is about the origin of modern attitudes to sex, how we think and feel about sex nowadays goes right back to this great revolution in the 18th century. And before that, ever since the dawn of history, really, every civilization had punished sex outside marriage. And if we look at the English-speaking world from the early Middle Ages right up until the 17th century, what's happening is that the church and the state and ordinary people are repressing sex outside marriage more and more severely. Sexual discipline is the key word, and that is becoming tighter and tighter everywhere we look.
So at the beginning, let's say, of the 17th century, on the verge of the revolution, what kind of punishments were being inflicted? What forms were the repression taking?
Well, one of the commonplace examples I start my book with is the story of two ordinary people, Susan Perry and Robert Watson, who are arrested one day exactly 400 years ago in the winter of 1612 in Westminster in England. And their crime, for which they're tried, is to have had sex outside marriage and to have conceived a child, even worse, outside marriage. And for this, they're put on trial. And when they're found guilty, they are sentenced to be taken immediately from the courthouse to the prison, to be stripped naked to the waist, and then to be flogged till their backs are bleeding from the prison all the way to the edge of the city. And they're to be banished forever from their hometowns, to be cut off for life from their family, their friends, their livelihoods, everything they know. That's an ordinary, commonplace, slightly severe, but a normal kind of punishment for what everyone in that society believes is not just a sin and a dangerous one, but a crime against society. And if you look at across the Atlantic by the early 17th century, where the Puritan settlers in New England are taking this idea furthest of all, there the ultimate sanction, the biblical sanction, the death penalty is on the statute books, as in other God-fearing Puritan societies across the Western world.
How does this square with, let's say, the love lyrics of the Elizabethans and the Shakespearean characters, Juliet and Rosalind? And I mean, I read the Shakespeare poetry and I the sonnets, and I have a feeling of wonderfully free expression of carnal lust.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So I think there are two things to say here. The first is that, of course, even before the 18th century, lots of people do have sex outside marriage. We know that because thousands of them are prosecuted for it every year, and undoubtedly many more get away with it scot-free. And the second thing is, though, that many of these celebrations before the 18th century in the medieval poetry and Shakespeare and elsewhere, they're celebrations of love much more than assertions of sexual pleasure. They're about relationships and they're about affection and attraction, but they're much less assertions of the modern idea, which just simply doesn't exist until the 18th century, that what you do with your body is a private matter and no one else's business, and that sex is a private matter. That idea only seriously becomes articulated and defended in the 18th century.
So the punishments inflicted on the two people that you began with in 1612, as the century proceeds, I mean, we have the Puritans in New England, but then we also have the licentiousness of the court of Charles II toward the end of that century. How does that bear?
Yes. I mean, that's really the late 17th century, the licentiousness of Charles II's court is the emergence, the beginning of new ways of thinking about sex. And the easiest way of capturing that is that it's the point at which we move from an essentially fundamentalist view of ethics and morality, which has prevailed up until that point, which says that there's one right way of behaving, and that's written in the Bible, and the Bible is the word of God, and the duty of every Western society is to follow that as closely as they can. From that kind of fundamentalist view to the one that you see the scholars and indeed the wits of the Restoration articulating, which is that actually truth is a very slippery thing, and truth in ethical matters is very hard to pin down, and people's consciences are perhaps a better guide to what is right and what is wrong than what is written in this text of the scriptures, which itself may in fact be not actually all God's word. And a lot of the ideas about sexual freedom come out of ideas about religious plurality and religious freedom that are being articulated at this time. So it's really central to some of the most important theological and philosophical debates of the time.
So that in the older version, in the repressive version, sexual misbehavior is not only damaging to the individual, but it's also damaging to the community.
Exactly. And above all, it seems that God hates it, and that God will not just punish individuals who have sex outside marriage, but will punish communities who tolerate it, as he did Sodom and Gomorrah, and it seems many other historical examples. That's the great fear, the fear of the wrathful God that lies behind a lot of the punitive legislation and the fear that communities have before the 18th century of tolerating sex outside marriage.
Also, during the period of repression, you have many ordinary citizens acting as God's spies. And
that's right. I mean, it's very important to realize that the culture of sexual discipline is not just imposed from above by the church and the state. It only works because ordinary men and women internalize it. And we can see this in two ways. The first is that there is no professional police force. Everything that happens to punish people for these crimes is a product of communal self-regulation, if you like, communities upholding standards and taking their turn as watchmen and constables and judges and juries. And the other thing that we can trace, which is very clear, is that the indoctrination of the idea that sex outside marriage is dangerous and bad has an effect, a palpable effect. We can trace the decline in births outside marriage, in sex outside marriage, because this is a pre-contraceptive society. We can see that the amount of sex that people are having outside marriage, the numbers of people who are coming to the altar, couples who are coming to the altar with the woman already pregnant, is decreasing measurably under the impact of the church's attempt to tighten up sexual regulation.
And you also have Bridewell, a prison for the correction of manners. Explain Bridewell.
Well, there are endless new places, and prisons founded to prosecute people for immorality. Bridewell is the first house of correction in London, founded in the mid-16th century to impose a new, even sharper form of punishment on all miscreants, especially at the beginning, sexual miscreants, where people are sent for a spell at hard labor to teach them not to misbehave and also to inculcate them with proper habits of industry. It's the scene, one of the scenes in Hogarth's Harlot's Progress in the early 18th century is set in Bridewell, where the harlot is set to work beating hemp. So it's an early form of retributive, it's an early form of how people are meant to be re-indoctrinated into the right way of behaving.
Talk about Hogarth. I mean, his sketches. I mean, the famous series, not only The Harlot's Progress, but also The Rake's Progress. Give the context of those apparently very popular drawings and etchings.
Yes. So the fascinating thing about Hogarth is that he is picking up on ideas and topics that are already of tremendous interest and fascination in early 18th century London. And that's partly why his visualization of them becomes so popular and enduring. And in The Harlot's Progress, he is encapsulating this essentially new idea about male and female sexuality. Until the 18th century, it had generally been held that prostitutes were acting out of their own lust, that they were just an extreme example of what everyone took for granted, which is that women were more lustful than men. And that's because women are weaker, they're less able to control their passions, and so in this case, as in others, they're more likely to fall into sin. And then Hogarth is showing this new 18th century commonplace that actually prostitutes are victims of social and economic circumstance, that they are trapped by men and by their upbringing, and that from an early seduction, which is what happens to the harlot, they decline into this spiral, ending in death. And so the 18th century is the point at which people start to advocate and act to save prostitutes, to save fallen women, to open hospitals for them, to start charities, to put them into employment. And this great crusade, which in the 19th century becomes known as the Crusade Against White Slavery, all epitomizes an essentially modern idea about men and women and their respective sex drives, but also about the ways in which individuals don't just act out of their personal sin or chastity, but are the product of social and economic forces outside their control.
Talk more then about the Enlightenment in the 18th century in England and the press, the idea of celebrity sex and the reveling in sexual adventure among aristocrats and courtesans of great power and beauty.
Yes, yes, I'd love to talk about that. It's a really fascinating theme. In the 18th century is born the idea that sex is private, that it's not the state's business, not the church business to punish people for having sex outside marriage. And the earliest and loudest advocates of this are upper-class, white, heterosexual men. The Earl of Sandwich, the great rake of the late 18th century, the inventor of the sandwich, and the man notorious already in his own day for sleeping across London, once said famously, what I do in my personal life is no one else's business. People should forgive my private affairs when they do not concern my conduct as a public man. That's a very important new idea, and we still work with that a distinction between the public and the private. But the 18th century also the time, unfortunately for naughty politicians, that the mass media are born. The first age of journalism, of newspapers, and London, which is the biggest city in the world by 1800, is the birthplace of all these forms of modern media. And one thing that they are fascinated with from the outset is people having sex and becoming famous for having sex. And so there's born this cult of the celebrity courtesan, the woman who is so desirable and so independently sexually powerful that men, even very powerful men, clamour for her attention. And it's the first age, great age of courtesans like Fanny Murray and Kitty Fisher, who are more famous even than their lovers, which include, or more famous in certain respects than their lovers, who include men like the Prince of Wales, the Prime Minister, and every great aristocrat of the late 18th century wants to be seen with a famous courtesan. It's a remarkable phenomenon.
So these women then become celebrities, and they're not therefore regarded as objects of scorn, but rather with a certain degree of admiration and affection.
That's right. I mean, of course, people who uphold traditional mores and standards decry this as, you know, these are not people who should be celebrated. But more generally, in the mainstream culture, they are the first pinups, for example. They not only are endlessly talked about and manipulated and exploited by the first mass media and the journalists of the day, they also control their own image in really remarkably modern ways. Kitty Fisher is the first of the courtesans who, clearly in league with the leading portrait painters of her day, churns out these images of her as a beautiful Cleopatra, as a woman of great beauty, but also approachability, because they have their portraits painted, then they're immediately engraved, and in their thousands are available for just a few pence in the print shop. So everyone can walk around with a tiny little image of Kitty Fisher in their snuff box and look upon it when they want, or they can pin it up at home and feel like they possess these women as well, even though they probably will never meet them or even see them.
So there's a tolerance for the loosening of the sexual behavior, and how does it also show, let us say, in novels or on the stage or in politics in the 18th century?
I'm glad you asked me about that, because I've tried to write a total history of the subject, and I really think that the most interesting, sophisticated, contemporary engagement with questions of ethics and morality and sex does come in the imaginative works of the period, in the great novels and paintings and plays and so on. So one of the interesting things is the way in which the novel, which is born at this time, of course, in the mid-18th century, becomes a conduit for educating people in new ways of thinking about seduction and the roles of men and women in sexual relationships. And this idea is also born in the first sexual revolution of the 18th century, that men are essentially the seducers of women, that men are the sex that are intrinsically, naturally promiscuous. There's nothing people can do about that. This idea is born in the 18th century. And that women are always being pursued. And one reason that becomes such a powerful, prominent idea from the 18th century onwards is that this is the point, for the first time in Western history, that women's voices break through into the mainstream and are heard on a large scale. Before the 18th century, women have really no public voice at all. They are not able to access any of the ways in which moral norms are prescribed. Theology, philosophy, sermons, newspapers don't exist. They essentially are silent in the public sphere. And then in the 18th century, women's voices become very powerfully heard, not just through the new public media such as newspapers, but also because women start to write as novelists, as poets, as dramatists, even as philosophers. And what they often talk about, what they're often interested in discussing, is relations between the sexes. And what they usually say is, hang on, this old idea that women are more lustful and that they are the dangerous seducers is not true. When we women look around and think and talk and experience our own lives, we see that men actually are always pursuing us. It's men who always try to get us to sleep with them and then blame us. That's a very novel idea, and it's bound up with this very novel development, the breakthrough of female voices.
Explain then, in very briefly, I mean, at the end of the 18th century, we have a promiscuous, flourishing sexual behavior on all sides. But how then do we get from there to the repression of the, say, the Victorians, and also in the United States in the early part of the 20th century before our own second sexual revolution in the 1960s?
Yes, I think that's a very important question. And one of the central themes of my book is not just that the first sexual revolution creates freedom, which it does, but also that this is a very unequal process. It's freedom mainly for white, upper-class, heterosexual men. But it also creates a whole range of inequities and double standards that also characterize the modern experience. Different standards for men and for women, different standards for heterosexuals and homosexuals and so on. And so what you see in the 19th century, what we think of as Victorian repression is very much the tightening up, or the attempted tightening up, of the sexual behavior of the lower classes, of women, the persecution of homosexuals. But it also goes hand in hand with the continued expansion of sexual freedom in other ways, and especially for ordinary white upper-class men. And one index of that is the huge expansion of prostitution through the 19th and into the 20th century, because that, to many people, seems to be the solution. If you believe, as they did, that women, respectable women, ought to be chaste, but respectable men are naturally promiscuous, then prostitution is the answer. So I think what you see in the 19th and through into the 20th century is the continuation and the sharpening up of these double standards that are born in the first sexual revolution.
And what does the second sexual revolution, the one usually associated with the 1960s, add to what had already been accomplished in the 18th century?
I think there are two things. One practical, which is mass contraception, the pill, really does have an important effect, especially in allowing women greater sexual freedom. The idea that women should have greater sexual freedom is not new. That also goes back to the 18th century, but this makes it really much more possible. So the disassociation of childbirth from sex. But the other important point, which is an intellectual point, is the rise and the increasing power of the idea of equality as the guiding principle in morality and in sexual affairs. The idea that there should not be different standards for men and for women, or for different classes, or for different races, that is an essentially late 20th century one, or at least the power of that, the power of that to overturn what the Victorians had taken for granted, that there should be different standards, is a remarkable facet of the second sexual revolution. And from that, you get the acceleration of equality for women, but also equality for homosexuals, and indeed for different races.
Having now written about the first sexual revolution in the 18th century and remarked upon the second one, is the sexual revolution still with us? Is it an ongoing work in progress?
Yes, it is. It's really fascinating to see. And I think in two ways. The first is, if we look around the world at the world beyond the Western culture, there very interesting parallel processes seem to me to be unfolding in terms of people's, in terms of the tension between fundamentalist outlooks and old ways of living and the rise of new forms of communication and new ways of living in cities and so on.
In the punishments awarded to your man and woman in 1612 are the kind of punishments that are still being awarded in parts of the Islamic world.
Yes. And I try at the end of the book to show the parallels between the two and to point to some of the ways in which we might think things might develop. I think in our own culture, what's fascinating, which also goes back to the first sexual revolution, is that on the one hand, sex is becoming ever more private in terms of the law and in terms of the state. We are ever more strongly convinced of the idea that people should be able to do what they like with their own bodies in their own bedrooms, and that's not a public matter. But on the other hand, sex is obviously, evidently, also ever more public. And the ways in which we talk about it, and the ways in which it's publicized, and ways in which the internet, especially in the last few years, has made that an ever-expanding part of our culture, are equally evident. So there's a great modern paradox that sex is both more private and more public.
It's always good to leave a conversation with a hanging paradox. Thank you. Thank you, Farah Dabhoiwala, for speaking with us today about the history of the first sexual revolution. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg, 2012.